You're listening to Art and Magic, and I'm your host, Devin Walls. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show, and welcome to the first conversation of this season. We're kicking things off with my good friend Andrea Gazzetta, and not only is Andrea an amazing artist, but she is so fun to talk to, and she's extremely knowledgeable. Extremely real. I mean, truthfully, nothing is off limits with her. If you follow her on Instagram, you probably already know that. And if you don't follow her on Instagram, you're going to find that out in this very conversation. So our original intention for this conversation was to talk about mental health and how we relate and navigate through that as working artists. But once we got talking, we ended up just covering so much more ground, and mental health only ended up being a smaller portion of the conversation. But I ran with it because I think you'll find the things we were talking about equally, if not more interesting. We also ended up just going off for quite a long time. So I'm going to split our conversation into two episodes, and the second part will come out next week. So I felt like that was a nice little bonus since this is a bi-weekly podcast anyway, to give you guys some back-to-back episodes since we're kicking off. So in this first part, you'll hear us talk about our own journeys with mental health, you know, our artist life in LA, money, making feminine art in a more masculine market, pricing, seeking validation, making connections with people. And then next week in part two, you'll hear us talk more about building your audience, navigating the art world, getting out of isolation, how to talk to people you don't know at openings. That might have been like my favorite part, making art books, how our trauma has influenced our work. Basically there is a wide range of topics in this two-parter, and I think you're really going to enjoy them. One little note I want to add about this episode, it is definitely an adult conversation with adult topics and adult language, so please keep that in mind when and where you choose to listen to it. And very, very small trigger warning, there is a mention of domestic violence. It's short, but I just want to let you know that ahead of time. Okay, a couple things to mention on this end before we get into it. First of all, as the podcast is returning, I would really love to get it out to more people. So if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us do that, or me, there is no us, it is just me doing this. but the best way is to write a review on Apple Podcasts and or share the episode you're listening to on Instagram. That is always so, so appreciated. So thank you to everybody who's already done that. If you would like to support the show in another way, I also have a Patreon where there is a library of exclusive bonus episodes that you can't hear anywhere else. So if you blew through the past seasons and you're wanting more, there are some episodes there for you. And then if you are somebody who follows my work and you're interested in my work, I want to let you know that next week, starting on Tuesday, July 18th, I'll be running a studio cleanout sale. And I don't think I've ever really done this, but I am ready to get rid of old work, make room in my studio, and, you know, create a bit of funding for my next paintings. So this will be the biggest sale I've ever done. I'm going to have a lot of studies, pieces, prints that are like maybe sizes that I don't typically offer, but I have them laying around, prints that have like a tiny little flaw in them, so they'll be sold at a discounted price. And then many of my larger, older pieces from 2020 and earlier, I'll be running a silent auction where you can make a bid and probably get like a very large painting for a very good price. So if you're interested in following that, I know some of the prints and smaller works will definitely go first. Patreon is, again, a great place to be if you would like early access to it, but if you just want to be reminded of it and not miss it, my newsletter is also a great place to be, and I will link to that in the show notes. So, if you don't already know her, Andrea Gazzetta is a Los Angeles-based artist originally from Wisconsin. She graduated from Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design with a BFA in sculpture. Described as Lisa Frank without her Xanax, Andrea's distinct style blends the traditional techniques of classical painting with a pastel aesthetic. She uses her bold, cheery palette to explore themes of intimacy, vulnerability, and the hidden magic of small moments. Andrea is also a return guest to the podcast. So after this, if you haven't already listened to episode 41 called Pay Yourself a Living Wage, that's a really great conversation too. It's actually one of our most popular. So I encourage you to head on over there. Okay, I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Andrea. All right, so since we're here to talk about mental health as a working artist, how are you?
I'm doing great, baby. Medicine is fantastic.
Agreed.
Can you believe our ancestors still were able to survive and make children without it? Because, like, clearly this runs in my family, but the only reason I'm here right now is because medicine. So I don't know what they did before then.
Yeah, that's a good point. I also wonder, well, I was about to say, like, maybe their lives were less traumatic, less influenced by capitalism and, like, all the things, but also probably not. They were probably like starving and struggling in their own way. Yeah. I think their life expectancy was just shorter too. So, you know,
that actually does make a lot of sense. And they just, like, didn't have TV or social media. So, like, you know, my mom says that my ancestors, like, on my dad's side, she's like, they're either alcoholics or workaholics. And, it's because your brain's broken. But in a time in a capitalist society, being a workaholic is pretty fire, and being an alcoholic means you die. So it's like, flip of the coin, baby.
Mm-hmm. I think we probably both fall on the workaholic side. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that there is this really intense misconception about artists that they're just so froofy and they just kind of, like, patter about from place to place. And it's like, I work more hours than a doctor, I'm telling you.
Yeah. No, if you're froofy, you're not going to make it. Like,
no,
straight
you can't.
Up.
You can, yeah. You can have fun. If you have a trust fund, you can do it. But if you're a working artist, you cannot be leaving time on the table. I think something that I really find interesting a lot is I'll hear people who are artists but have a day job, and they're like, well, I don't really do my art because I have my day job. But if I quit my job, then I would have all this time to do art. It's like, no,
false.
If you quit your job, you're going to be worrying every single day about where your money is coming from. You'll actually make less art that you like. So don't do that. What you have to do, unfortunately, is do your day job, then make art at night like a little gremlin by the light of some crappy lamp that you've purchased online that says it's a wonderful product for artists, and it's not because it has three crappy LEDs in it. And none of your videos will look good, but that's what you have to do to build up an audience until you can quit your job. It's a slow process. So I always find it really interesting when people are like, I have 35 followers on Instagram, I should quit my job so that I have more time for art. It's like, no, if you're not making art now with your day job, you're not going to make art when you quit.
100%. Yeah. I think about that all the time. Like, when have I made the most art? And I actually think it was during the pandemic when I got unemployment. That's the best, right? It's like, you have the money and you have no day job. But other than that, like, anytime I was working another job or just, like, I don't even know, was getting by in some other way, I'm pretty sure I made the same amount of work, if not more. I mean, now I make such little work because my process is slow, but, like, even that aside, just the hours and time I'm able to put in, it's like the same, if not less now.
I spend a lot of my day, like, figuring out how I'm gonna do my taxes, worrying about doing my taxes, and then still not doing my taxes, which we're due in April technically, but we have till October, thanks California. But I still haven't done my taxes. I spent a lot of time worrying about it. I had a mental breakdown, 0 stars. It is very stressful to be a full-time artist, especially if you don't have a partner who is financially supporting you or parents who are financially supporting you. If you're really out on your own, sometimes you wind up making less work that you love because you have to take on commissions or you have to take on other types of work to still make ends meet. And there's this bizarre misconception. This happens all the time where I'm like, this is really difficult, I'm struggling. People are like, would you like to make my stand-up comedy poster? I will pay you $30. I'm like, you're the problem. You're the problem. You're the whole problem. Because it will take me 10 hours to make something that's good, and you want to give me $30 for it. And so that goes back to our previous conversation. See episode 41, Make a Living Wage with Andrea Gazzetta. I know that not because I'm crazily obsessed, but because I had to update my CV yesterday.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Yeah, but it goes back to that idea that as artists, we don't deserve a living wage because we're just like doing our fun thing. It's like, you think I want to make your dumb comedy poster? Absolutely not. You
Yeah.
know, if I'm doing commission, it is because I need money. I would love to parlay commissions, and I've started being able to make my commissions things I actually would be interested in doing anyway. But anytime someone else is telling you what they want, it's still not what you want to do. That's just how artists are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even
The
if it's
second
really
I'm like,
close.
yeah, even if it's super close, it's just the
Yep.
fact that I have to do the thing. I have to like meet that whatever
Requirement.
requirement, intention, whatever is just, yeah. Yeah, I
Sometimes it
agree.
makes doing work for shows difficult because I'm
Oh,
like,
yeah.
do I really want to do? And I've started saying no a lot more. Basically, what I've started doing is I just have a sketchbook. The sketchbook has all of these like ideas that I'm like, this will take me at least 2 or 3 weeks to execute. I know that I can't do this right now for no reason and have no place to land it. So I have my sketchbook just kind of at the ready. And then when someone asks me to do a show, if I have a sketch ready, I say yes because I'm like, ooh, I could use this sketch for this show because it's something I already am excited about and already want to do. And that means I'll actually be motivated to do it. So, for example, Arch Enemy Arts has a Spectrum show. And the other day, for my Patreon people, they had like one of the animals that they chose that they wanted for me to do was wolves. And I wound up going, creating this concept that I was like, oh, this is way too cool to do on like a 4-inch by 4-inch piece for my patrons. It has to be bigger to execute this well. So I saved it and I set it aside. And then they reached out to me and they're like, hey, do you want to do this show? It's a Spectrum show. So the whole color, like the main focus has to be purple. And I was like, great. I have this painting I've already designed. It's ready to go. I just have to execute it. So stuff like that is very helpful in saying no to more things. I try to manifest more like solo shows or like things where it's like you can just do whatever you want type shows, because that's where we as artists thrive, you know?
Yeah, indeed. That's super smart too about the sketchbook. I should start doing that because for me, the part that takes the longest is the conceptualization. And that's also the part that like is really hard for me to rush. So if I just
Yeah.
had a bunch of that done, I mean, I can power out the painting. In air quotes, my version of power out is quite different than most people's. But nevertheless, like I could figure it out, but the conceptualization is like if I'm on a time crunch, it just it's not
Well,
good.
because what happens too is you get stuck in like, is this idea worth executing? And that happens to me a lot, is like, is this worth doing? Do I care about this enough to want to do it? And then you kind of set it, you're like, no, it's not good enough. And you keep trying to like think of things that fit this small little box that the show wants you to step into. And by the time you found something you like, you no longer have the time to execute it to an ability that you would like. So you try to like compromise, and then you wind up making something you don't like anyway. So I try to just have that sketchbook. I really give myself at least a month of lead time when between like painting and execution. This particular show, I'm cutting it close because I'm going on vacation. But I already have my sketch ready. I have my like panel planned out. So when I come home, I just have to paint it. So that helps a little bit.
Okay, I want to go on back to something that you casually mentioned,
Is
your
it
mental
a
breakdown.
mental breakdown?
No, we don't have to go. We don't necessarily have to go into that,
No, we
but I
should.
do. Well, I'll let you take this question wherever you want.
For sure.
But I thought that since our topic today is mental health as working artists, that maybe we
Whew.
would both just, yeah, it's a super light topic.
Just like super chill. I have a cucumber sandwich right here.
Yeah, I thought we could both talk about like our relationship to mental health, maybe how it's changed over the years, and just like a little bit of context of where we're both coming from in this conversation.
Absolutely. I had a mental breakdown. What happened was, my hands started hurting. If you're an artist and your hand is hurting every day and you have deadlines and you have things you need to do, that's not great because that is how I do stuff. So what started happening is I was taking a bunch of ibuprofen, way too much ibuprofen. ibuprofen, the maximum dosage. And then it started to make my stomach hurt. And then I started not sleeping. And then I started just the stress started building up. Cause what happened was I kind of overloaded myself on deadlines a little bit. But I, as a person who has experienced trauma, something I'm working on with, I just got a new therapist, also a stressful thing to switch therapists, very stressful. For the better, you know, my old therapist was great. I loved her. We had a great relationship. But she kind of was like, I've taken you as far as I can take you. You need to kind of graduate to a new type of therapy. So what I'm studying now is the link between the mind and the body. So the central nervous system and how trauma and anxiety specifically can manifest as physical pain in the body. So for me, it generally comes in like my neck and back and shoulders. They like tense up when I'm stressed out. Also, because of something that happened when I was very young, when I was like 5 or 6, this thing was happening where my parents were getting divorced and my dad was threatening to kill my mom. So all the time when I was a kid, in the middle of the night, my mom would wake us from sleep, take us somewhere else. The police would come. It was just this big hullabaloo. It was very traumatic. And so what happened is my brain is wired that when I'm stressed, that sleep is not a safe place. So I started to have this stress and anxiety and pain, and my body was like, we can't sleep. So I started having panic attacks when it was time to go to sleep. So basically for an entire month, I would lay down and try to go to sleep, and I would have a panic attack. And so I just wouldn't sleep through the night. So then the next day I'm tired. I'm more stressed out because I have all these things to do that I can't accomplish because I haven't slept at all. So it became this like sort of vicious cycle. And I was doing, you know, yoga and acupuncture. And I went to the emergency room and I was like at this point where I was just like, I need help. And every time I would ask for help, someone would be like, have you tried a breathing exercise? Have you tried chamomile tea? How about a melatonin? Have you tried a melatonin? I'm like, no, we are past melatonin, babes. Like, this is beyond. And finally, what happened was I went to the emergency room. The emergency room doctor's like, there's nothing physically wrong with you. Because my mom has a thyroid condition. So I was like, maybe it's a thyroid condition. They check my thyroid. They check my heart. They're like, I think you're just really stressed out. So I called my insurance company. I was like, hey, so I went to the emergency room. Like, y'all need to get me into a psychologist like ASAP. And they're like, great, we can see you in 2 weeks. And I had to file a formal complaint with the hospital after, of course, not sleeping at all. I was like, no, we're done. Like, I have asked for help. I've been to the emergency room. I've been to urgent care several times. Y'all aren't doing shit. So I filed a formal complaint with the hospital and they put me on this drug called Remeron. I'm on the like generic version of it. But essentially what it is an anti-anxiety antidepressant that has a sedative in it. So I take it right before bed and it makes me go to sleep. But part of the problem was I was developing anxiety about going to sleep because I experienced so many nights in a row where I didn't sleep at all. So as the sun would set, I would have a panic attack because I would be so anxious about not being able to sleep. So I did that. I basically lost almost 2 months of work. I really didn't work during May at all. I didn't work during much of April. And it became this problem where now I'm, even though I'm medicated, I'm still stressed out because I'm dealing with the after effects of what is essentially a mental breakdown. And it's hard because my body fundamentally views rest as an unsafe space. My body has not ever really known how to relax. So now I'm on a drug and it kind of cuts off that, like, it takes the hard edge off, I would say. But my body is still learning how to, like, hey, we need to take a break. You're tired. You should sleep. You can't start a painting. It's midnight, you know? And it does help that I take a pill to go to sleep every night. So there's kind of like a hard shut off. But I don't recommend it. I recommend not doing that if you can avoid
it. I recommend not having trauma.
Yeah. If you could just like not have trauma, that would be amazing. Yeah.
And that's really like, good genetics.
Yeah. Super good genetics. Yeah. Well, here's the thing about it too. Because I talked to my therapist and I was like, has anyone not had trauma? And she's like, oh no, everyone's had trauma. And so I think that also helps to put it in perspective. But I think that some people have more resiliency. Either they have a better support network of family and friends, or they have, you know, other resources. And I think something we do not talk about enough when we talk about mental health is the effect that poverty and scarcity and capitalism have on individual mental health. Because there's this sort of westernization of Eastern philosophy. So like the Eastern philosophies of like yoga and meditation and all of these things are really meant to help you understand that we are all intrinsically connected, that everyone's experience is universal, that the pain and suffering you go through is a universal like thing, like everyone's going through that, and to help you feel compassion both for yourself and for others around you. But we have sort of adopted and bastardized it to make it fit into capitalism. So we've said like, well, if you just meditate enough and you just have a positive outlook, all these good things will happen to you. But meditation, there's not enough meditation in the world that can change fundamentally a structure that does not care about you, that does not have access to healthcare, that does not have access to affordable housing, that does not have access to a living wage. So ultimately, the mental health crisis we're seeing in our nation right now is directly linked, in America especially, to the disappearance of the middle class, the, you know, hoarding of wealth by billionaires. You can't separate class from the mental health crisis that we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, 100%. And I think as, you know, as a working artist, like a lot of us, not all of us, but many of us are drawn to being artists because we have things to say, we have trauma to work out, we Absolutely. Are sensitive, we are like insert thing here. There is definitely a correlation between like difficult mental health states and creativity. There's been like studies on that. I'm not saying like it's for everyone, but I am just saying it's likely that if you are creative, you have an experience with challenges with your mental health in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And with that, you're also going to really bump up against all the problems within the structure because there's not a lot of support for working artists. You're going to deal with like the lack of health insurance. You probably are going to struggle through like stressful finances, especially in the beginning. And so you're kind of like at the crux in some way of the intersection of a lot of these issues, which is why I think like it's interesting for us to share and talk about it because we're experiencing it in a certain way.
One of the things, so like my therapist the other day asked me to describe like when your nervous system felt okay, like when you felt safe. And most of the times I could think of were when I was making art. There is a direct link to the process of art making and your body's ability to feel pain. So if you're learning a new task, if you're painting, if you're engrossed in creating a song or learning how to sing or something else, those are things that put you, they are like a meditation. It's like meditation for your body. So it puts your body in your body. It puts your mind in your body. So your mind is not feeling the physical pain, but also the emotional pain of PTSD, trauma, etc. So it is very much like a self-soothing. So part of my breakdown was because my arm was in pain, my main coping mechanism is making art. That is not just my coping mechanism. It is also my only source of income. So that became a problem because now that was triggering more pain and unsafety because I couldn't do the one thing that helped me self-regulate. And so that becomes this like horrible snake eating its own tail of awfulness that only drugs could fix and kind of like put a break to. But it is something where like the reason I make art is because of early childhood trauma, probably, and a mix of neurodivergence, definitely. But also, I think that art making is different from jobs, quote unquote. I think art making is a vocation, and it's something where you know, my boyfriend and I will be hanging out. He'll be like, what are you thinking about? I'm like, a painting I want to make. Like, that's just what I want to be doing all the time. And it's hard for me to stop doing it because my mind is like obsessed with the act of creation to an extent where I almost have a hard time understanding collectors. Like, I love collectors. I'm so glad they buy my paintings. Thank fucking God they buy art. But I am not a collector because for me, the interesting part of art is in the making of it. And so I will, you know, occasionally I'll buy art from my friends that I can actually afford, or we'll do a trade or something. But for the most part, for me, the most fascinating and grossing and satisfying part of art is in the making. And then once it's made, I'm like, I don't care. Put it in a box. Who cares? Like,
yeah.
The art making helps you find what you're trying to say. And it is the, I don't know, it is the therapy, or it is the art. The art is when you're making the art. And then when it's done, you can talk about it with people and you can talk about the idea that is like trying to get out of you. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking a lot about how you and I, in a lot of ways, have such similarities and then are also such opposites. So let me explain.
Yeah, please.
So I got into art. I've talked about this a lot already, but like, I got into art as a way to soothe my depression. Like, you know, I wasn't in art school. I literally started doing it as a therapeutic act. So like, that's
what was your degree in again?
I don't want to say.
Do it.
No, I'll say it's philosophy.
Philosophy. That's right. I knew it started with the P, I couldn't remember if it was psych or philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
From a fancy institution.
That's right. Fancy institution that I'm doing absolutely nothing with at this point. So that's okay.
No, honestly, I'm proud of you because I think it takes a lot as someone with a philosophy degree from a fancy institution to be like, I'm not going to inflict this on others.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I realized that my first year in. I was like, ooh, this is kind of just like an ego competition.
Yeah.
Mostly
for
white
sure.
Dudes. So yep, absolutely. Not feeling it. Yeah. So it was actually at that time, that was probably actually part of the depression of that particular time, where I started making art. And then, you know, there's a big, lots of gaps to fill in from there to here. However, I'm thinking about, you know, you saying this is the thing you do as your therapy. It's how you process. And when you can't do that thing, it's the snake eating its tail. And for you, like, a lot of your trauma has at this point in time manifested as physical pain. And that's been kind of the issue.
Yeah.
And then for me, I have like really serious depression. And so where you have, like, you can't turn it off, I have a hard time turning anything on. And so it's like,
you have art constipation.
Well, it's not really art constipation so much as it's just like everything constipation, just in terms of like, it's not necessarily specifically related to art. It's just that depression makes it hard to do literally anything or think about literally anything. Right.
Absolutely.
And so, like for me, a lot of the reason that I can't get to my therapy is because of my depression, which is like the issue in the first place, and it becomes a cycle, you know? And so there's that. And then also on this note of capitalism, like because of my depression and chronic fatigue, I also work very slow and I have a low output, and capitalism like demands that you put out so much, you know?
That's so fucking real. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's super real. So it's like artists already struggle with that. Even if you work quickly, like something handmade and intentional fine art painting is never something that is going to be produced in the way that capitalism wants. But then you throw my conditions on top of that and there's like extra, extra. And so, yeah, I don't know. I was just listening to your story and I was like, it's funny. We both do have things that like hinder us from doing the thing we need to do, but they're almost coming from opposite places, but they are also both rooted in trauma. And yeah, I just found that interesting in us being friends.
Well, I think that too, capitalism has rewarded a lot of art that is, I'll call it hypey, where it's like, there's a dude, he's an artist. He paints the same face every fucking painting. it's the same style. Sometimes it's wearing a suit. Sometimes it's wearing a famous cartoon character's suit. Sometimes it's this. And capitalism rewards work like that because what he has essentially done is he's created a formula. The formula is, I make a dude who has big eyes or who has an animal's face or whatever. I do this over and over and over and over again. Collectors want exactly this. Mm-hmm. And I sell it for really big money. The end. I see so much of that art. So much of it is from men. So much of it is because a lot of people who collect art, who have the money to spend on big art like that, are men because of the wealth disparity, because of the income disparity in America. And it rewards this kind of like simplistic non-thinking, because if you're really like thinking and taking time and exploring your work or changing your style or discovering something new, now the people who followed you or who started liking your work, because I like when Andrea paints cute animals, I'm not super into her collaging cotton balls to create cloud people going through portals. You know, that's real. And I've taken a lot of risks. I've made work that doesn't super sell. Hey, at me if you want that. They look super cool. I think they're amazing. I've sold some of them, but I made 30 of them. I didn't sell 30 of them. But it's true that the more sort of authentic and the more that you explore and try to change, which is the joy of making, like the joy of making is becoming something new or seeing something new in the world and making a new thing. But capitalism really rewards this sort of like almost factory output. And that's where, you know, you draw your drawing, you hire an assistant, they finish the painting for you, you know, you reap your $10,000, you have a big studio, you go to a fancy opening and you do it all again. And that is when like the art becomes merch. And I feel like that kind of stuff is just not interesting to me because it feels wildly inauthentic.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's because it's like simplistic enough for these certain collectors to want to collect, and therefore because they sell, the galleries want to keep like championing it?
Yeah, I do think that. I think I see a lot of work, especially by men, selling really well that I'm like, oh, this is mediocre at best. Like, mm-hmm. It's just not that good. It's not that interesting. Your technical abilities are fine, but you're not saying anything. You're not challenging anyone. You're not getting deep into yourself in any real way. And stuff like that, I think, is flooding the art market right now. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, what capitalism rewards. So I think it's hard to, like, I do think that if you want to take chances as an artist, you need to find some type of balance that allows you to maintain an income stream that you can count on. Mm-hmm. For me, that's commissions. Like, I do so many pet portraits, dude. I'll paint your dog wearing a hat. I just really don't want to do that, but I will do it. But I do a lot of pet portraits, and I like painting animals. It's fun, you know. Yeah. Does it fulfill my soul? No. But it allows me to make enough money that I can really push myself and do things that I want to do. And what's hard too is that, you know, a lot of like art grants and things like that fall on the other spectrum, where like I feel like my work personally is like very feminine, it's very childlike, it's very illustration-y, and it's very easy to kind of overlook and say like, oh, that's just cute. Mm-hmm. You know, and not really look into it any further or examine it any further. And so it's hard to get those like artist grants, mm-hmm. that are like, we want a woman making art about how hard it is to be a woman. It's like, well, I live that. I don't need to make art about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's already hard to be me. Like, I would rather not. I'm not interested in making art about that. I think there's this weird idea too that art needs to like bring awareness to issues. It's fine if your work does that, but I think it's just as valid if it doesn't, because I think that issues are like I guess I could talk about being a woman. I guess I could make art about the pay gap. I guess I could talk about men grabbing my ass or, you know, people talking over me in meetings. But I live that enough and I don't really want to talk about it. I'd like to use my imagination to look deeper into my soul and like look deeper into what is love? What is death? Mm. Why are we here? Those are interesting questions to me. If a dude grabs my ass, that fucking sucks, but that's kind of on him, you know? I don't have to make art about it.
And I would say for both of us, and particularly you, like just by making work that is so feminine in nature and colors that are so associated with femininity and girlhood, like mm-hmm. it's already like either a statement in itself or edgy in and of itself, because like it's not as valued. And so yeah. you're already taking a stance from the feminine perspective just inherently by making work like that. And so am I.
And, ooh, yeah. Devin and I did a 4-woman show with women who all do brightly colored artwork, and no one sold a single piece. And that was heartbreaking. It really hurt my feelings that we didn't sell, that no one sold a single piece in that show, but it was all very feminine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Feminine looking, rainbows, bright colors, the things that we tend to pass off. And I do think that, you know, women's work is something that we as a society generally just don't value as much.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to keep making it because I think it's cool as shit.
I mean, it's also kind of bringing to mind for me two things. One, it's kind of like, this is why it's so important to build your own audience. And I can just say for myself, what's been really rewarding, like on the flip side of all of this, like, you know, kind of like surface level repetitive work, selling easily through certain galleries and all that. What's been so cool for me is that in my sphere with my audience, like, I feel like I've brought in a lot of people who really do want to look deeper at the work and really do appreciate the like nostalgic and feminine aspects and really resonate with it.
Yeah.
And that's super cool. And like, I think that's what is cool about this time, you know, alongside all the shittiness, is that there are people who like those things. It's just not necessarily always the dudes collecting at some of these bigger galleries. And then on the gallery note, something that like I've been thinking about, and I think you and I have talked about it a little, it's just like a question I'm asking, is like, I feel like there must be merit in having the right fit for your work. And I feel like a lot of the galleries that, you know, are in our sphere, for lack of a better term, just happen to have a lot of male collectors, and absolutely. Like their aesthetic is more on that side of things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of like, there has to be other spaces that are less like that, that are probably better fits. I just don't fully know what they are yet. And I'm thinking for the show where we didn't sell anything, that might have been part of the reason why.
I agree. I do think so too. And I think there are a few things that I found, like, I don't have as many like Instagram followers as you, and I still haven't figured out TikTok because frankly, it's just too much for me right now.
It's a lot of work.
It's so much. I already am like, this is already, social media is already too much work. But it is nice, like, especially having my own podcasts where people learn to value you as a person. They learn to value what you have to say, your insight. And it turns out that people kind of become fans of you. And I'm sure you've experienced that similarly because you have your own show. And building your own audience that way is so rewarding because sometimes you make art for someone where it might be the only original piece of art they've ever owned.
Yeah.
They're not a collector. They're not collecting things because they want to sell them later and have value, or because you're some fancy artist with a big name. Like, they're collecting your piece because they value you as a human being and they value the insight that you're bringing into the world. And that is so freaking cool. And it's such a different relationship than you have with someone who buys your work through a gallery. I've sold, there's a big piece that I sold at a gallery, and it's one of my favorite pieces I've ever made. It's the whale carrying like the polar bear and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know who bought that painting. If it was you, let me know. But
and you've made your way over to this show. That's freaking cool.
Right? Come hang out. What's up? But it's weird because it's like that was one of my favorite pieces ever. And now it's going to go live with someone that I don't know, you know, and I don't know if they know everything that went into it. I don't know how they're connecting to the piece. And so that it almost feels like giving your child up for a blind adoption versus when someone buys directly from you. A lot of times it's like, oh, I know them. I know it's going to be loved. You know, there are a few pieces that, you know, people have messaged me and been like, I really want this piece. Can I buy it? You know, there's the unicorn terrarium that I did, the little one with the heart. And they're like, I've just been really wanting this piece. Can I buy it on a program? And they did. So they're giving me $250 a month. They have one more payment to do. And I gave them a discount because they're one of my patrons, but also because I know that it's going to the right place. You know, It's like, I know that this will be loved and cherished. And that's exactly where I want all my paintings to go. And so when you build your own audience, you can kind of do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you make more money, which is great.
Yeah. And let's not forget the most important part.
The money. Money is important.
The money.
It is baffling to me how much we as a capitalistic society value money, probably more than God, and also won't talk about it.
Yeah.
And that drives me totally insane because it's like the number of times I have been comparing myself to another artist I see doing X, Y, and Z on social media only to find out they still live with their freaking parents or their parents are giving them a trust fund or whatever. And you're like, oh my God, actually the fact that I'm surviving it all is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I have to remind myself that all the time. I have to tell, you know, like I have a lot of friends who aren't artists and they're always like, oh, that's so cool, you know? And then they, well, actually two comments on this. One, I think artists are super comfortable talking about money because we have to talk about it with each other. But I've noticed that like all my friends who have more salary jobs and stuff, I feel this different, like, can I ask what you make? I'm like, is that rude? But like with my friends, we talk about pricing and money all the time. So it's just this like interesting thing. But anyway, I did get into a conversation with a friend who has a 9-to-5 and I found out what she made. And I was like, holy shit. I had no idea you were such a boss, you know? And I was like, wow, in comparison to you, you don't want to know what I make. But then I'm thinking like, yeah, maybe for an average American, I make little money, but for an artist, like I'm crushing it. Like
that's kind of the reality
of being a working artist. And you have to kind of like remind yourself of that. Yeah, it's just interesting.
Yes. And it is also this thing too, where like, I think a lot of artists have a hard time pricing their work to give themselves a living wage, Devin.
I know. I struggle. I struggle. Here's why. I've talked to you about this a little bit, but I'll just say it for the people listening. Is like, I think I started my prices so low that I'm like still recovering from that. And I don't want to shock my collectors. So I'm trying, and like every release I have brought them up a significant amount. I think I'm almost there to like be what I should be charging. Like the next two releases, they'll be there.
In fairness too, though, your painting from even when we met like in real life or whatever, or became Instagram friends during the pandemic or whatever.
Yeah.
Like your painting abilities have also increased significantly.
Yeah.
You have leveled up a lot as an artist in the time that we've known each other.
Yeah.
Like, especially going from just going completely abstract to painting realism to, you know, introducing the airbrush and your shading. Like this last round of minis you did, I was like, fuck yeah, girl, these look great.
Hey, shout out to you. I never like fully, I've kind of like alluded to the fact. I love how we're getting so off topic mental health, by the way, but I'm like, whatever, this is interesting. But I've alluded to the fact like, oh, I consulted my artist friends and they said I need to do still lifes. But no, the real story is I came over to your house and I was like, bro, I have this huge painting that I can't tackle. And you really had to sit down and convince me and show me how to focus in and make simpler work. I was like, I don't think I can do that, man. Like there has to be a story. And you're like, well, throw a damn chain on it. Like make it whatever. Yeah. Like you need to do something more fundamental. And I had a really hard time. Like I was so convinced after that conversation. I was like, I left your house. I was like, okay, I'm motivated. Like Andrea's so right. I'm so inspired. But then when I sat down to do it, it was so hard. Like I barely made it through. And I think that's because I just have an obsession with doing something so elaborate and so conceptual and like so all of these things. I'm not sure what that's about. If I get back in therapy, I should probably ask her.
That ties back to making it being worth making.
100%.
Like, when you feel like your brain is like, well, I only have X amount of time to make things.
Mm-hmm.
Is this worth making?
Yeah.
And in your brain, you're like, well, it has to be the most elaborate, fantastic, amazing thing. And like, I also struggle with that. I'm getting to a place where I'm like, I just want to go bigger and bigger and bigger. And spoiler alert, it's harder to find people to buy big paintings because they're expensive.
Yeah.
But that also, I think, ties into feelings of your own value. Like, if you feel like you're not painting something worth painting, quote unquote, it's like, am I worthy to call myself an artist? Am I good enough as an artist? Am I good enough as a person? Will people love me? Will people love the work? And that goes back to that, like, you have to find that sort of confidence in yourself. That's like a huge mental health thing that I struggle with all the time.
Dude, truly.
Not tying your value to what you create. Like, I'm still a person worthy of love, even if I don't make a big elaborate painting. That's the coolest thing in the room.
Yeah. You know, something I've noticed actually on that note is as I've been like more involved in like the art scene, I mean, I barely am, but like the little bit that I've been attending and in getting involved with. But sometimes I will go to these shows and meet with these people and of course I'll feel so inspired. And then I'll leave like, oh man, that was so cool. I can't wait to create something. And then there's this fine, fine line between being inspired and feeling like I really want to play with the big boys. Like I really want to be one of these people. And so I got to go and like kill it and make something like amazing. And that's like a horrible way to approach your work. Like good luck creating from that place. And B, it's like, all right, I really need to examine my intentions here. Because now it seems like I'm looking for some sort of self-validation that goes way beyond just artwork.
Wow. That's so real, dude. I feel that in my spirit. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super real. And I think also like that happens a lot as a woman who I would say you and I both look maybe a little bit younger than our age.
Oh, thank you.
I often get still carded or hit on by people who are like 21, 22. I'm going to be 35 next month. But people who are in their 20s usually think we're the same age. So when I meet people in real life, like at our openings or whatever, there is always sort of this assumption and people kind of treat me like I'm younger, or they don't really take me seriously until or unless they've seen my work. And then they're like, oh, actually, you're good. And then they treat you very differently.
Yeah.
But it is hard because as someone from the Midwest, like I really like when I go to art openings, I really just want to make friends. Like I really just want to be like, I like your art. Do you like my art? Can we talk about art? Can we be friends, please? Can we do that? And I think in Los Angeles and like bigger art scenes, especially, there is a hierarchy. You know, I did a show at a bougie gallery and like they forgot to put me in some of the artist photos because the photographer knew me from working. I work at another gallery during the year and the photographer also works at that gallery. He didn't know I was an artist in the show. He thought I was just hanging out. And I was like, no, that's my piece right there. And he's like, oh, that's like one of my favorite ones. I was like, yeah, I'm an artist. I'm actually really good. Just because I work for another gallery on Saturdays to make money and like make connections in the art world and meet people and stuff doesn't mean I'm not talented, you know? Mm-hmm. So it takes time to kind of like earn your place. And that can be really like demoralizing to kind mm-hmm. of feel like you always have to earn your place. And I especially am someone who I really feel like it should always be about, is your work good? And it doesn't matter how many followers you have. Like, I'm someone who I probably follow too many people back. But if someone follows me and I see their art and I'm like, this is awesome. Even if they only have 1,000 followers, I'll follow them back. Because for me, it really is about making connections and meeting people and being inspired. And like, but it is easy to get in that place of like, am I good enough to be here? Am I good enough mm-hmm. to be in the photo? And so that is definitely something that I'm working on in therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very real. The pressures are very real. And I think like staying grounded and staying connected with people who care more about what matters, aka the work and yeah. doing things from a genuine place, is kind of the key to staying connected to yourself.
My brain is thinking of Marissa, who gives no fucks about anyone.
Of course,
anything.
I'm thinking about Marissa. I'm thinking about you and Marissa, but definitely Marissa. For
I
those
love
of you who
her
don't know,
so much.
Yeah, we're talking about Marissa Avila Saylor, who's been on the show a couple times and will be on this season too.
Her Instagram handle is @speaking_in_rainbows.
Yes.
And she gives zero fucks. Yeah. She uses swear words in her art. It's part of the reason I started following her, she and I were in a show at the Art Bar in Venice. And I just saw her stuff and I was like, this is pretty fire. But then when I hear her talk about art and her, you know, struggle against academia and stuff like that, like Marissa gives zero fucks about mm-hmm. academia, accolades, what anyone thinks about her. She's like, I'm going to just keep doing me and y'all can suck my dick. And I'm like, yeah. I will suck your dick. Like, yes, this is amazing. Absolutely. Like, and I love you for all of it.
Yeah, I have felt so lucky to like get to be exposed to like so much amazing art by being close to LA and yet yeah. have connected with and found the people where I feel right at home and so supported and like we all really care about what matters and who are totally not swept up in the bullshit.
Yeah.
And I've thought so many times like this is where it's at. And like if that means like your work ends up being more categorized as lowbrow or maybe like a bigger gallery doesn't end up being your thing, like I would take this over that any day. And again, that brings me back to like why building your own audience is so empowering.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I've also sort of like, because I work at a major lowbrow LA gallery right now that I'm not going to name, but you could yeah. find it very easily by looking at my social media in 5 minutes. It's fine.
Yeah.
But through that, I've sort of started to like put a face to the name of artists that I've followed and respected for years. For example, like Casey Weldon shows with the gallery I work at, and he came to our Lulusta Jesus show because he was
oh that's
town.
Right, he tagged me. Yeah,
he did, and he was in town for another show. And like I've always kind of considered Casey to be like an upperclassman, you know, yeah. of like, oh my god, you're so amazing. Him and I want to make sure I'm saying this, Amy Soul. I want to make sure that I said the right name. So him and Amy Soul both came down because they were in a Think Space show that I was in. It's a benefit called Fuck Cancer. And I was at the opening and I got to meet them. And I was like, so like, oh my god, you guys are like amazing. Like I've known about you since I was a kid, like all this stuff. And they're like, we like your art. And I was like, what? Like,
yeah.
Are you serious? But I think that even artists that you think about, like there are artists who are in the bullshit who like you think like, oh my god, they're so amazing. And they're like, I'm just here to take off my shirt and be hot and like be this amazing artist that everyone loves. But then there are artists who, even though they're doing well, even though they have a solid following, even though they're showing these major galleries, it's still really about the work to them. They still just want to have a good time. They still just want to make friends. Like, there are authentic people even in those areas that aren't swayed by the bullshit. And I'm like, oh, I hope, you know, I was like, oh, I want to like get like you someday, but also still be grounded and still feel like I can make friends and, you know, do stuff like that. Cause that's the whole reason I started making art in the first place.
Yeah.
It's because I wanted to connect with people in an authentic and real way, you know?
Totally. And yeah, actually a little bit on the mental health note, which is going to end up being the least talked about thing in this episode.
I know. We talked about so many things.
Which honestly, it's totally fine. But, you know, part of my depression has led to a lot of isolation. And that's been, and like as an introvert and as an artist, like even just those two things alone, like you're probably going to be isolated. And then you add these other factors on top of it. And so it's been something I've struggled with my whole life. And also, like, quote unquote, finding my people has always felt very, very hard for me. Like, I've always found myself in different environments where I'm like, all right, like, these people are nice, but like, I don't really feel at home. Like, I don't feel like these are my people. And that was like a question that I asked myself so much throughout life. And it really wasn't until I think I started connecting with people, like making work adjacent to mine and with similar goals as me. And really like through art and through the art world that I was like, oh, these are my people. And so it's like, you know, as much as I was so afraid to like enter this realm because of all the bullshit that definitely exists, like on total opposite end of that, there's also like the coolest people to ever exist.
The coolest fucking people you've ever met.
Yeah.
It's hard. And I think too, part of that for me, I felt very much the same way. And part of that for me is being undiagnosed neurodivergent. So I was undiagnosed ADHD and I got diagnosed at the age of 33. And it's like, this is what happened. I called the psychologist and I'm like, yeah, so like sometimes I forget stuff, but I have a really high IQ and I was in honors classes and I did really well in school. But sometimes I just like forget things exist, like my car insurance, and then I just don't pay it because I just forget it exists. And I moved out to California to do stand-up comedy while working for a stained glass studio. And now I do neither of those things, but I have a podcast about art history. And he was like, yeah, you have ADHD for sure. You just do. But being neurodivergent, part of it is like you relate to people through like parallel play. So I have a really hard time hanging out with people and not doing anything. I'm like, so we just like get a coffee? Like the fuck is that?
Yeah.
And we just chit chat? Like, no, like one of my best friends is a glass artist named Meg, and she lives in Colorado and she has her own studio. And we became friends because we would just make glass together. So I'm a glass painter by trade. I would paint glass and she would like, you know, she taught me how to solder. I'm still not very good at it because I work for a glass studio. I only did painting and cutting. But we'll still every two or three times a year, I'll fly out to Colorado. We'll make glass for a week straight and then I'll go home and it's like the best week of my life every single time. And it's like, I just get to hang out with my friends. I get to hang out, you know, she has other people who work for her in the shop. They're all beautiful and lovely people. So we just get to all hang out and make art together and then I leave and it's super fun. And it's like, if every day was like that, like something I actually struggle with as an artist is just being lonely. Mm. Like when I make art by myself, I just get lonely. So I've started trying to invite people over to make like, hey, do you want to just make art while I make art? But that can be hard too, because my apartment's small. It's not super set up for a bunch of people. And so I have to make sure that I have tasks I can do that like either I'm like packing prints or I'm drawing or doing something that I can sort of like talk to someone while I'm doing them at the same time, or we can just listen to music and be together. But I've had to start like I actually make a point to invite one friend over a week so that I see my friends, because I have all these people that I love, but I like forget they exist because I have ADHD. So yeah, all of that like neurodivergent speak, I guess, is like, you get what I'm talking about. I went on a huge tangent. I have ADHD.
I absolutely get what you're talking about and relate in so many ways. I think for one, if you're neurodivergent and like have mental health issues, have anxiety, whatever, it's hard to make friends. You're already going to be isolated as an artist. It's hard to socialize in ways that are deemed normal. And so what's really cool is when you find other people like you and you're like, but what if we just like talk about colors and materials and nerd out and
yes,
and go to the art supply store and then like make stuff next to each other and like share space. And that's why I bring it back to Marissa. Marissa's studio is awesome.
It's
and
amazing.
I'm like, can I move in? Because she has like a very comfortable big studio where like people can make work. Yeah. And I love it. So
I love it so much. Or you start a podcast so you can talk to your friends.
Totally. It's how I met a lot of my friends. All right, y'all, that wraps up the first part of this conversation. To hear the second part, be sure to come back next Thursday. If anything, I think the second part is even juicier. Some of my favorite things come up then, so stay tuned. In the meantime, if you'd like to follow me or the show, those links are in the show notes, Art and Magic Podcast and or Devin Walls Art on Instagram. Also, be sure to go follow Andrea and keep up with what she's got going on. Her handle is at Andrea Gazzetta, and that is also linked in the show notes. So thank you so much for being here. And until next time, I'm sending you lots of love.